The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, January 23, 2019, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. Today's interview show is a very special one for me. Today would have been Ernie Kovacs' 100th birthday. For those of you new to the name, Ernie invented sketch comedy for television in the 1950s and 60s, taking full advantage of TV as a visual format, unlike many of the shows of his era. He was also the host of The Tonight Show for the better part of a year, and if you like subversive TV sketch comedy, late night comedy, much of the credit goes to Ernie for paving the way not only for David Letterman, but Monty Python, SNL, so many other legendary shows and performers. Personally, I feel like I have a spiritual connection to Ernie that I can't quite explain. To say he's one of my biggest influences is totally underselling it. In fact, you might be surprised to hear that I approach many of my creative endeavors, writing, podcasting, you name it, with Ernie's spirit in mind. I also spent several years working with author and Kovacs biographer David Wally to develop a screenplay about Ernie's life. And so today's show is dedicated to both Ernie and my friend David Wally, who died back in 2005. To honor my old friend and, of course, Ernie today, my guest is Josh Mills from ErnieKovacs.com. Josh is an Ernie Kovacs historian and is currently organizing a series of events to commemorate the Ernie Kovacs centennial. So please enjoy today's interview, if for no other reason but to honor a personality who contributed so much to TV entertainment and yet isn't fully recognized by his own industry. Oh, and if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/join/Bob Seska Show. And now, hold it, don't nobody move, let's talk Ernie Kovacs with Josh Mills. Hey, Josh, it's Bob Seska. How are you?
Bob, how are you?
Good. First of all, you're doing amazing work at ErnieKovacs.com. How did you end up running that website?
Well, my mom was married to Ernie. Her name was Edie Adams.
Oh, my God. So, wait a minute. So I was one of my questions I was going to ask you is, did you ever meet Edie? And of course, the answer to that is obvious.
Yeah,
wow.
I did a couple times, yeah. Ernie passed away in 62.
I was born
in 68. She'd married my father, who was Martin Mills, who was a photographer, in 64. I was, like I said, 68. Essentially, when Ernie passed away, my mom, there's a, if you want to get into the California law thing, but essentially, I don't know if you know the full story, but, Ernie left a lot of debt behind. And
yeah.
My mother had to pay back a lot of that debt. So a lot of the stuff that exists today is purely from her efforts of preservation, but also paying for it a second time.
That was a huge endeavor for her. I mean, she had to, she didn't want to take any charity, so she basically worked through all of it, right? I mean, because everyone was coming out of the woodwork in Hollywood, is like, let us help you with this. And she kind of, said, no, wait, this is our responsibility. This was mine and Ernie's responsibility, so I'm going to take care of it. Is that right?
It's exactly right. And, it's funny because, obviously, Ernie was a gambler, and there was some debts there. There were some IRS issues. But the part that not a lot of people know is that here we are in 2019 talking about, are we going to have a 70% tax bracket? Ernie and Edie were in a 90% tax bracket at the
time. Unbelievable.
That was a, imagine earning, $10 for every $100 you made.
Exactly.
There were a lot of issues. Ernie did spend, my mom did spend, they lived well. The other issue was that, Ernie produced a lot of the stuff that he did, and especially the ABC specials, which were the last things that he worked on. Ernie didn't understand below the line and above the line and what ABC was responsible for and what he had to pay for, so he went over.
Right.
So there was about $500,000 in debt when he passed away, and my mom absolutely said, I will work it. I will pay this back. I will work, but you got to give me a little time. I can't pay this back today, but it'll be over about a decade, and she did.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, Ernie was of this philosophy that if he earned this money, this was his money. He didn't have to give it to the IRS.
Yeah.
And of course, the IRS said, well, wait a minute there, Mr. Kovacs. We've got some other ideas about that.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, the other thing is that my mom didn't talk about it very much. Of course, I wasn't around then. But there was evidently a very well-known IRS agent who worked in the Hollywood circles who was looking for kickbacks, and Ernie refused, and that's supposedly what started audits and why they were in a 90% tax bracket. So we'll just leave it at that. What do I know? I mean, hey, it's only, you know, 58 years ago.
But, and, of course, a lot of the shows that he had to do in those days, especially in the very early 60s, were shows that he didn't necessarily want to do these shows. He kind of had to do these shows because he was so much in debt, and the IRS was attaching almost everything that he had to take some things that he didn't want to take.
Exactly. I mean, Ernie was definitely a person that did not take kindly to anybody telling him what was funny and what wasn't funny and what should be done and what shouldn't right. be done. So, yes, there was a point towards, you know, I'd say the last 3 years of his life where he was, you know, take a good look, as great as it is only great because of Ernie's genius, but right. he took it because he had to, and he didn't want to do a game show, but he said, if I'm going to do a game show, you got to let me do it the way I want to do it.
Right.
He did another thing with silent films called Silence Please, which was a replacement in a sense for Take a Good Look. So there were a lot of things that he took because he just needed the money. And, you know, Hollywood paid well. But again, if you're making $100,000 a picture, but you're only taking home $10,000, mm-hmm. it's not paying a lot of bills.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, you know, issues with creative control go all the way back to Ernie's first television gig in Philadelphia, right? Three to Get Ready, where he mm-hmm. was doing his own thing for the most part. And then WPTZ stepped in and said, well, hold on a second. We've got to rein you in a little bit. And I'm sure he hated that, right?
Yeah, he was really just a person that, you know, unlike a lot of people, he wasn't a stand up comic. He didn't tell jokes on stage. He wasn't someone who worked, you know, like that. But he did have an idea about what he thought was funny.
Right.
And if anybody, I mean, Ernie, you know, people talk about, you know, politics or whatever. Ernie had no politics. His politics were, if you were a politician and you took yourself too seriously, you deserved a pie in the face. That's yeah. as far as he went in that. But yeah, he didn't like anybody telling him what to do. And anybody who took themselves seriously, whether it was an executive or a president or someone in Congress, deserved a pie in the face. Yeah. He thought that was, you know, perfectly acceptable.
And that's the thing about Ernie. Let's get down to sort of the meat and potatoes of what Ernie is most known for, which is sidestepping, I think, what was happening a lot in the early days of television, which were a lot of radio comedians basically doing radio on television or doing vaudeville on television. And Ernie saw this
exactly.
as a brand new format that he could exploit for what it was, which is a visual medium. And so much of what he did and so much what he's still known for now is how he basically invented visual comedy on television, right?
Absolutely. You know, Ernie was not, like I said, he wasn't a stand-up comic. He didn't come from vaudeville either. Yep. He wasn't someone who had, he had a radio show, but it was not like, you know, I don't know, Amos and Andy or, you know, anything else like that. So he wasn't basically translating, you know, a radio show into a television show and just putting, you know, three walls up. So he, and if you think about this in a more abstract way, you know, in 1951, when he's on television and just starting, the idea that he had in his head about a visual medium was clearly not something that anybody had ever done before. So the fact that he had a thought and a vision and a process and wanted to, you know, make this more visual is really what makes him, you know, television's original genius, because it's who, aside from, you know, I don't know, silent films or something like that, there was no precedent for this.
Right.
So it's really amazing that that he thought of that. And, you know, a good friend of mine and the estates is Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
And one of his quotes was just, you know, I don't understand how Ernie thought he could do this. I don't know where he thought in the back of his mind, because it had never been done before. But he
yeah.
just, that was him.
Yeah. And it was right from the get-go, right? I mean, just as soon
yeah,
as he stepped 100%. On television, as I said, his first television gig after he was on WTTM in Trenton on radio. And then he
yeah.
went down to Philadelphia on WPTZ. And right out of the gate, he was doing these insane things. He'd have these these characters. In fact, you know, one of his most famous characters that he would bring along and eventually brought along to Network was this, I don't know how you, a giant woman doll, basically, named Gertrude. And, you know.
Yes, Gertrude. You got some deep cuts going here, Bob. This is
great.
Oh,
my God, yeah. I mean, I was really good friends with David Wally, who wrote one of the only two biographies of Ernie Kovacs. And he and I actually worked on developing his biography and a play that he wrote based on his biography into a biopic. And we started writing this. And then, of course, David Wally died, and it didn't go anywhere. So, But in that process, I was able to get insights into a lot of these characters from David Wally, who, of course, spoke with your mom and spoke with a lot of people who worked around Ernie. And he actually thought a lot of these characters that he invented for the show were kind of real to him, weren't they? I mean, he really had that kind of imagination where he would project human characteristics onto these inanimate objects, no matter whether it was, Gertrude or sleeping Schwartz, or you know what I mean, where they were just all these random characters, very much like if you watch the old Letterman show, it was very much like that.
Yeah, not just Gertrude. I mean, there is a bunch of puppets that Ernie did with the Kapusta Kid in outer space, and I just watched some of them over the weekend at the UCLA Film and Television Archive salute to Ernie's centennial. Mm-hmm. And, he's got the Kapusta Kid, and my mom was a character, and he's got this other character who's got this thick Italian accent, but is named O'Brien. And it's subtle and weird, and there's just moments where you're kind of like, where is this going, and what is he doing? But you kind of pick up on it later and think, wait a minute, how's an Italian character having an Irish last name? And that was just the way his brain worked. It was absurdity, it was surreal when it was visual. But he really had a plan that, you know, wasn't always apparent in the moment.
No.
But when you kind of thought about it later, it had a big effect. But Gertrude was, you know, a main character in Philadelphia, I believe, for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, there was Howard, the world's strongest ant. You know, such a Wolfgang Sauerbraten. I mean, just an incredible array of characters. My all-time favorite sketch that he did was as one of his most famous characters, as Chef Miklos Molnar. And he does a sketch, and it's, in fact, I think it's the first one on the first VHS tape of The Best of Ernie Kovacs, where it's Chef Molnar preparing chicken Molnar, which to me holds up just as funny as anything you'd see on Saturday Night Live today or any modern sketch show. That was so ahead of its time. I can't even imagine, Josh, being an audience member, being a viewer of television in those early, early days, seeing one of those sketches must have been mind-blowing, don't you think?
Oh, clearly. I mean, you know, and what's great about it is that, Ernie's Hungarian. Miklos Molnar is obviously, you know, based on somebody he knew in his life. Could have been his father or someone else.
Yeah,
and, you know, the fact that there's Hungarian characters, at all, I mean, think about New York in the 50s. There was a part of New York City that was called Germantown. I mean, there was so much ethnicity and so many things around him that I think he just incorporated a lot of that stuff. I mean, he grew up, you know, in a very, you know, in Trenton, New Jersey, and then obviously there was a big Hungarian population. But Miklos Molnar is amazing. There's a great sketch that he does with Howdy Doody called Howdy Deedy. it's a visual thing. I can't, it's like, you know,
I know
dancing about architecture, unfortunately, but I can't describe the joke, but he basically cuts, you know, the strings off of Howdy Doody because he can't stand them. And, it's great stuff. I mean, and, you know, Matzo Heppelwhite. I mean, you know,
oh my God, yes.
I mean, these are great names.
So who do you think was Ernie's biggest influence in terms of his visual comedy? I mean, who did he grow up with that kind of implanted some of these ideas in his head? I mean, beyond the ones that he just literally invented wholesale out of his own head, where did he learn visual comedy?
Well, you know, I do think that there was a silent film aspect to him. He was born in 1919, and we are celebrating the centennial this year. Can't forget that part.
Yep.
I think it was silent film. I mean, the very last thing, literally the last thing Ernie did the day he died, was a show called Medicine Man that he was a sort of like, you know, Carnival Barker type snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
And his sidekick was Buster Keaton, who was sort of a Tonto-like silent character.
Yep.
And I think that that would have, you know, again, probably took it for the money, but at the same time, the chance to work with Buster Keaton probably was too much to, you know, pass up. So I think that he, you know, aside from the people in the neighborhood and his mother, who was a very interesting woman, to say the least, I think those are the things that influenced him.
And then there were his parents, of course. His dad was a bootlegger, yes, during Prohibition, and his mom, as you said, was quite a character. What was Ernie's relationship with his mother?
Well, you know, he, like all good sons, he was very much beholden to her in many ways. But yeah, I think it you know, she was not easy. And of course, I never met her. I've heard stories, not just from my mom, but other people who were around at the time, my father. You know, a perfect story that I remember hearing about many, many times, and this will give you a good insight into to Mary Kovacs, yeah, was she was very histrionic about a lot of things and complained. And, you know, after a while, people started to not pay as much attention to her. Well, one day she's outside the house and she's screaming, "The car just ran over me. The car just ran over me." "Yeah, Mary, the car ran over you. Sure. The car ran over me. You got to take me to the hospital." "Yes, Mary, we'll take you to the hospital." And they take her to the hospital. They take off her shirt, and lo and behold, there is a tire track across her breast.
Oh, my God.
And first of all, the fact that it didn't kill her tells you something about Mary Kovacs.
Yeah, second, it's of kind of amazing. That, you
know, yeah. And second of all, the fact that, you know, crap, she was telling the truth. You know, that's the kind of relationship, you know, it was very difficult, I know, for my mother, mm-hmm, to deal with Mary, because Ernie really did want to have a separate and private life.
Yeah.
But it was his mother, and his mother needed a little bit of help. And so she would go on vacation with them, and she would come and stay at the house and live there. And so it was not always easy, but she was a complete character. I mean, another very quick story, but, you know, you were saying that, you know, Ernie's father, Andrew, was a bootlegger. Previously, he was a policeman, and then all of a sudden they had all this money because he was a bootlegger.
Right.
And she bought him, you know, ponies, and she dressed him like little Lord Fauntleroy, mm-hmm, and he lived like a king. And then all of a sudden, you know, Prohibition ended and he had no money. So
right,
he lived a very eccentric life with them.
Yeah. And then, you know what, he went on and did, it was sort of the normal trajectory at the time in entertainment. You start out in theater, and then television, and then film. His early years were kind of interrupted with, a health scare. He ended up with pneumonia. And then what happened once they got him in the hospital to recover from pneumonia? Didn't things went horribly awry at that point, didn't they?
Well, I am not 100% sure it was pneumonia. I think he had pleurisy, which is just as bad.
Right.
But he was in a pauper's hospital. He had graduated high school. They had no money. He was trying to be sort of a stage actor, you know, living in a cold water flat, making, you know, very little money. And he ended up getting a disease that basically almost killed him.
Yeah.
And he was in the hospital for a good 9 or 10 or 12 months. And with, you know, radio, but, you know, newspapers, no television, not a lot to do, not a lot of money. He had to kind of make things up to make it bearable to live like that. So supposedly a story goes that, you know, they would take an X-ray and he would grab the X-ray and take a pen and write, you know, "cut here," to make himself laugh and to try to make other people laugh.
Right.
He couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
So he went through a very difficult time. And I think that that was probably the time that he sort of, whether he knew it consciously or not, realized, you know, life is short. I have to live it to the fullest. Yeah. And whatever is going to go on, I'm going to control it, because I just don't know what's around the corner. And I think, you know, his tombstone does literally say "nothing in moderation," which is, yeah, literally how he lived his life.
Yeah. And in fact, that was the original title of David Wally's biography of Ernie Kovacs.
Oh,
and,
perfect.
And he ended up, I think the publisher ended up changing it to "The Ernie Kovacs File," which is a lot less interesting, but I guess it's got the subject's name in the title. So there was an advantage there,
marketing,
I guess, from a marketing point of view. But yeah, I mean, there's so much of Ernie's comedy, I think, is based out of those kind of stories. Like when he was at the hospital messing with the X-rays and so on, he was mischievous and very much a prankster. I mean, there's so much of his, and you know, I actually have a copy of his book that he wrote later. It was a fiction book called Zumar, but of course it's based on actual experiences that he had in television. And this book, the guy who sold it to me said, oh, yeah, look, it's autographed. It's an autographed copy of Zumar. I was like, oh, I got to have it. First edition. Yeah, first edition autographed. And now looking back, I kind of wonder whether or not that was an Ernie Kovacs prank. Like, actually, all the copies of Zumar are autographed as just part of the printing process. It was actually a printed page, maybe, or something along those lines. That, you know, that was kind of Ernie's mindset. Like, let's do something subtle. You may not get it right away, but eventually you'll get it, and you're going to laugh your ass off.
Yeah, I mean, he really had a very childlike way about him.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
very much.
The thing that's amazing to watch when you watch his shows, and it really does come across mostly on like some of the NBC shows that maybe are not as well known. But he's so relaxed. I've never seen anyone on television. You know, the gag could go awry, it could go great, it could, you know, be as planned, or it could, you know, completely go off the rails. He didn't care. He was happy enough to be there and, you know, make fun of whatever happened, good or bad, and kind of mock things. But, you know, my mom would tell me stories that, you know, they'd be driving in a car and there'd be a kid in the car next to them and he'd be making faces, or Ernie would be making faces back to him, and they'd go a couple blocks and the kid would make faces, or he'd keep making more faces. He just thought it was fun.
Right.
And evidently kids just thought he was, you know, he was imposing. He was a big guy. He was over 6'2" and mustache and cigars and, black hair, but very funny, and kids loved him. So yeah, he was very childlike.
He was unusual visually for the time. I mean, when we think about, for example, a show like The Tonight Show, we think Steve Allen, we think Johnny Carson, and that kind of classic Midwestern kind of waspy look. And Ernie Kovacs wasn't any of that. I mean, he was this big guy with, you know, dark features. And of course, Hollywood capitalized on that by basically typecasting him as various swarthy, you know, quote unquote, swarthy characters.
But, yeah.
And so even just visually himself, he was unusual, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely Ernie was, quote unquote, ethnic at the time.
Right.
You know, we just, again, at the UCLA event, we screened Our Man in Havana. He plays a Cuban in that movie. A little better than Charlton Heston as a Mexican in Touch of Evil, but we'll move on. I think that Ernie's appeal was that, you know, if you saw him, you might think that he was intimidating. But as soon as you got to know him, that he wasn't. I mean, my mom said, one of the things that was so great about living with Ernie was that every day was fun, and it could be, you know, the best eggs he'd ever had that morning, the best coffee. And isn't it terrific? I mean, he woke up sort of in a manic high. I mean, frankly, he didn't sleep very much. He was an insomniac. He, you know, I think everything was a joy to him. And it was, frankly, I think because he was alive. And he could enjoy these things, and that's why he wanted to spend money, and he didn't care about what the IRS said. I mean, he literally just didn't pay his taxes at a certain point. So, you know, it was reckless, and in the end it was getting fairly dark, but he lived a pretty damn good life.
Yeah, I mean, his daily schedule, especially when he was really in the thick of his popularity, was just absolutely insane. I think he would sleep maybe 4 hours a night, right? He would spend a lot of time in a sauna, taking basically a steam bath, smoking, 20 cigars a day, and playing all-night poker sessions with some of his entourage. Describe what your mom was kind of observing about that period of time. What was it like to live in that whirlwind for her?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, during the years they were on the East Coast, in Philadelphia and then in New York, it was different from when it was in Los Angeles. But, you know, my mom luckily had her own career, and she was doing Broadway at the time that Ernie was doing a lot of his television and radio stuff. So she was on his show a lot, but then there were times where she couldn't be because she was in Wonderful Town, and in 1952, I think in 1956, she was in 55, Little Abner, and she won a Tony. So she was sort of the weird toast of Broadway at the time that Ernie was doing his thing. So they were very much a power couple. So I think those times were really fun. I mean, my mom would tell me that, you know, she'd wake up at noon and, you know, start her day then, because she had been out the night before doing her Broadway shows, and, you know, going out to dinner at Sardi's and, you know, eating at 11:30 at night, eating a steak. So I think later it changed when they moved to Los Angeles. My mom was doing, you know, her thing, but Ernie was doing his thing in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. So I think at around that time in Los Angeles, things started to change a little bit. I think money became a bit of an issue. I think that, you know, at one time, both my mom's mom and Ernie's mom were living in the house with Ernie and my mom and his two kids.
Right.
So it got a little wacky for a while. So, different time periods, different things, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine, I'm sure you have access to photographs of that house, the house in LA with the,
I grew up in that house, actually.
Oh, you did. So you're familiar with like what? Like the fake wine cellar or the real wine cellar with the fake cobwebs. Is that something that remained? Do you remember things like that? All the weird Ernie Kovacs things in the house?
Absolutely. I mean, what was strange was that, you know, my mom's last name was Adams, and I do remember watching the Adams Family and thinking, you know, they're not so different from our family. I really did think that there was some weird connection because in the house, not the actual house, but Ernie's den, which was just off the house, he had suits of armor. There was a railing, and instead of like a banister, it was swords. And he had dueling pistols, and he had polar bears and bearskin rugs. I mean, it was very... I mean, Hemingway-like. I mean, it was dark. It was very manly. But it was kind of cool. I mean, I was totally fascinated with everything in there.
Didn't he have one of those on-air lights outside of his office that said, "Not now"? I so desperately wanted one of those. Just a sign to put outside my office that says, "Not now." And I flip a switch and the light turns on and people know not to come in.
That's exactly true. And that was basically to signal anybody that they were having a card game or maybe, quote unquote, a writing session. That nobody was to enter, even if it was food or drinks. If they wanted something, it would be known. But otherwise, not now.
Right.
That was for sure.
You know, it's never really acknowledged that Ernie was the host of The Tonight Show. It was briefly. It was October 56 through January 57. But he still did it. And yet... when they commemorated, I forget what it was, the 60th or 70th anniversary of The Tonight Show, not a single mention of Ernie as being memorialized as a host of that show. I mean, again, Ernie getting lost in the shuffle, but I mean, he'd often joke, in fact, about how Steve Allen would steal his bits. But I mean, we'll get into that in just a second. But I mean, why do you think Ernie doesn't get recognized as being a host? Is it the short period of time, or is it just that... geez, he's such a strange tangent from the trajectory of The Tonight Show in terms of the style of the show. What do you think it was?
Well, you know, it's one of those things I would love to rectify. And I know that there is a CNN documentary coming next year that we are very much pushing to make sure that Ernie's included about late night television.
Wow, great.
You know, essentially, there was a point when Steve Allen was the single host of The Tonight Show, but NBC gave him, I think, a Sunday night slot. And he said, "I absolutely cannot do both of these shows." So the compromise was, okay, you can do three nights and Ernie will do two nights. So Ernie did two nights for about 6 months. But the interesting thing was it was 100% Ernie's show.
Yeah.
It was different writers. It was a different look to the set. We do actually have three of those Tonight Shows in our archive.
Wow.
And just recently I found a file or a bunch of files from the Tonight Shows, and it's got budgets and it's got all sorts of, production notes and things like that. So he clearly was an official host. He just didn't do it five nights a week for, 30 years. That was the issue, I think.
Maybe that's true. But I mean, again, he wasn't a fill-in host. He wasn't like Joan Rivers or Burt Reynolds sitting in for Johnny Carson.
No.
He was a legitimate host of the show, and yet he's not necessarily recognized for that. And in fact, as I was alluding to just a second ago, Ernie would often joke about it, and I don't know how serious he was, and maybe you can fill in the gaps on that, but he would often joke about how Steve Allen was just stealing his bits. I mean, the Answer Man was ripped off from Ernie's Mr. Question Man, which was even a funnier bit to do. A lot of the man on the street stuff that Ernie invented, even going back to Philadelphia. That's the kind of stuff he was doing, where he's breaking that fourth wall and going out and talking to real people, or, you know, messing with the camera and so on. And then Steve Allen started doing that.
Well, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I will say my mom was very friendly with Steve and Jane Meadows. So there was no, you know, animosity.
Yeah.
But my mom told me that the story was that, evidently, and I don't know if Steve Allen knew this or not, but somebody in his office, when Ernie was doing his Philly show, would be watching the show in Philly and feeding, basically by telephone, the jokes and the sketches back to the writers for the Steve Allen show, which is a national show in New York. And that was what pissed Ernie off, was that he was a local guy in Philly, and nationally, Steve was getting all the laughs. I think that pissed him off.
Right, right. And in fact, the Mr. Question Man bit that became Steve Allen's The Answer Man, the Mr. Question Man bit involved Bill Wendell, who was also David Letterman's announcer for 15 years on the old NBC show, and even David Letterman's morning show, which in fact, the very last Letterman morning show, that's when I first heard the name Ernie Kovacs, because Bill Wendell on that last show paid tribute to Dave and said, thank you for giving me this opportunity. You remind me of a guy I worked with for many years, Ernie Kovacs. I was like, who's this Ernie Kovacs guy who David Letterman is so much like? And so that's how I first learned about that. But again, going back to the characters that he that really define Ernie Kovacs's career, describe the Nairobi Trio.
Wow. That's like trying to describe a Dolly painting. I mean, okay, here's the thing. If you've never seen it, you're not going to think this is funny.
Right.
But it's basically three gorillas in bowler hats, in long sleeve dust, or long dusters.
Yeah.
And there's a song, song of the Nairobi Trio, and it's a syncopated, dialogue sketch to music.
Right.
And it's, again, surreal and weird and bizarre. And it's one of those things that you're kind of watching, like, where's the punchline?
Yes.
But it's just so bizarre and weird. There's a punchline at the end. It's not a, you know, big, you know, pratfall type thing.
Yeah.
But it's a trippy, weird sketch.
The Nairobi Trio, I mean, in of itself, worked every single time. And it was so strange. And it was almost like, I was kind of looked at it as almost like animatronic, almost like the Chuck E. Cheese animatronic characters that you would see. And they looked like they would move almost robotically. And then in the end, one of them would get bonked on the head or something. So there would be some mishap that would fall out of line of the choreography of the song. But it's, again, so strange. And it's, by the way, it's not lost on me that we're doing an entirely audio-only podcast discussing a visual comedian. So I just want to throw that out there that, yes, I get it. You know, but if someone, Josh, put a gun to your head and demanded to know your favorite Ernie Kovacs sketch, or maybe a character or a sketch, which one would you end up choosing?
Wow. You know, it's weird because I just recently watched the ABC specials, and he's known for his comedy, obviously, but there are two bits that he did. One was a Bartok thing that was not funny at all. It's it's moody and it's creepy and it's kind of interesting to a Bartok piece. And it's fantastic and weird. So I've seen so much stuff of it. I kind of like the stuff that not a lot of people pay attention to as much. But I mean, you could take your pick. There's characters that are great and sketches that are great, but I just kind of thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And in fact, not all of them were supposed to be laugh out loud funny. They were just supposed to be strange, and he was experimenting, and everything was very surreal, as you can tell by our attempt to describe the Nairobi Trio. Used to describe it as coming from the back of the brain.
Yeah, that was my mom's saying it. I mean,
Your mom came up with that. Was your mom's description? That wasn't Ernie's. That was your mom's thing for describing how he came up with his stuff.
I believe so. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think it was my mom who I heard her say it many, many times. But I think that, you know, Ernie's way he looked at things was that, you know, again, television was in its infancy, and he made sure that everybody knew that you were going into somebody's living room and they be in their underwear and t-shirt and, you know, kind of scratching themselves. You had a lot of people who were, you know, in vaudeville where they had to be big and broad and, and those kind of things. So that uniqueness, I think, of Ernie is that he helped the medium do and actually, you know, utilize it where other people didn't.
Yeah, in fact, I think from what I recall, he wasn't interested in performing in front of a studio audience. He much preferred working out the bits ahead of time and shooting everything and either, you know, basically doing it live to tape or cutting it together after the fact. I mean, he wasn't really into that audience experience insofar as he would play directly to a home audience, which were just a couple of people sitting in their living room, right?
Yeah, there's a famous thing that my mom mentioned that when Ernie and my mom, because she was on Broadway, they became a bit of a cause de libre. Vegas wanted them, and they wanted an act, and they went out to Vegas and did 3 months or 5 months or something like that. Got paid very well. Ernie got to gamble. He was very happy. Mm. But when they were putting the act together and testing it out, you know, the pit bosses or the boys with the, you know, the noses, you know, were kind of saying to my mom, like, Edie, you got to tell Ernie, like, this is a big room. You can't play to the first, like, you know, five rows.
Yeah.
So Ernie didn't really know how to do that. He worked really small. My mom, who was in Broadway, she knew how to actually do things bigger and broader because she knew she had to hit the, you know, people in the back of the orchestra. That's not the orchestra, the loge or whatever.
Yeah.
And, so that was it. Ernie really did work small, and it didn't work that well in Vegas, frankly. But
that's one of the things that struck me early on in going through Ernie's material when I first discovered who he was, is that he would actually speak to the audience much the way that we're talking to each other now. It wasn't his performance really wasn't big and performancy. You know what I mean? Where there, you know, there were certain performers on television who were doing exactly what you were describing. They were projecting to the back of the room and so on. They were very big personalities. Ernie was more subtle. It was more conversational and real. Does that make sense?
Well, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the audience, his audience was never huge. It wasn't like he was Milton Berle. It wasn't like he was Jackie Gleason. I mean, he didn't get huge numbers, which is why he was on four networks and he was on, you know, morning shows and afternoon shows and radio and late night.
Yeah.
But the people that did find him, my mom's big thing about this was that, you know, if you found Ernie, you were a fan.
Right.
You really were looking for him and trying to find his show. So you were trying to find something special. And I think that the coolness about Ernie is that even when I talk to people now, they feel like they had like a personal connection to him.
Yeah.
Where I don't think a lot of people had a lot of connections other than, you know, there was a great gag on, you know, Sid Caesar's show. And I don't, you know, I'm not disparaging Sid Caesar. He's a legend. He's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a different kind of comedy.
Very different. Extraordinarily ahead of his time. I mean, that's the one thing that you can absolutely say about just about anything Ernie Kovacs did is that I don't think the world was necessarily ready. I don't think American audiences were ready for him beyond, I think, the cult following that he had, which is the real shame of it. I mean, I think that's ultimately the tragedy of Ernie Kovacs's creative life, is that I don't think at the time he was appreciated by mass audiences as much as he should have been. I think the people who worked with him, obviously some people in his celebrity entourage, Jack Lemmon and others, were appreciative of the kind of things Ernie Kovacs did creatively. But he didn't really catch on until, I think, much later when the world caught up with him, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he definitely was ahead of his time. And if you look at it in context to where we are now, I mean, this is pre-Beatles. This is pre-Kennedy assassination. I mean, this is, you know, black and white television. It's a totally different world.
Yeah.
And I think that in many ways, you know, he was able to harness whatever talent or ability he had and kind of make it special and unique and different. What was the root of your question?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I mean, essentially, you know, how it required basically Americans and a viewing public to catch up with Ernie rather than the other way around. Ernie wasn't chasing the audience necessarily. The audience was chasing Ernie all the time. Like, what is this? Oh, God, what is he doing now? You know what I mean? And then eventually they caught up.
I'll give you a perfect example of that. You know, there's a story that Terry Gilliam from Monty Python, who grew up in Minneapolis, the one American member of Monty Python, loved Ernie. And supposedly on the first Monty Python tour of the States, he took two or three of them to the Museum of Broadcasting, now the Museum of the Paley Center, and said, I'm going to take you to see somebody you've stolen everything from, but you've never seen before. So I there were people like Terry Gilliam and some people on Saturday Night Live, or, you know, we can go down the line. But I think those people got him and understood, you know, and Letterman and the writers on Letterman, like those folks. I think that that's where, you know, Ernie kind of caught up.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, you know, there was a character, as I mentioned just a second ago, there was a character that Ernie did for an entire half hour episode of his show. And the character's name was Eugene. And this character went around in such a strange little universe of his own, where at one point Ernie set up this entire set on a gimbal so that it was tilted, and then they tilted the camera with the gimbal so that everything that was happening on the set looked like it was happening on an angle. Like, he'd go to pour a glass of coffee or whatever, a cup of coffee, and the liquid would shoot way out to the side because, of course, the whole set was tilted, right? And so it was a lot of little, like little episodes like that, all kind of tacked together. And of course, the world didn't catch up to that until Rowan Atkinson stole the character and called it Mr. Bean, and then it became a big hit thanks to Rowan Atkinson. Whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know, but that's kind of how that worked out, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting about that one show and that character is that supposedly the Martin Lewis had just broken up, and NBC said, we're going to give Jerry Lewis 90 minutes to do a special, whatever he wants. He's going to be the biggest entertainer in the world. We're going to let him do whatever he wants. So supposedly Jerry Lewis says, I don't want to do 90 minutes. I want to do 60 minutes. So they have to fill 30 minutes at the end of the 90.
Yeah.
So they went to all these comedians and nobody wanted to follow Jerry Lewis. They thought it was suicide. And Ernie said, I'll do it, but you cannot tell me what to do. Whatever I come up with, you're going to have to do. And they said, fine, because they were like, great, we're going to have Jerry Lewis, who needs, you know. Well, when the show airs, when both shows air, Jerry Lewis doesn't really get much kudos in the press, but Ernie gets a huge write-up in many papers about how great his show was.
Yeah.
And that's what led to Life magazine. He got on the cover of Life magazine, and that's what led him to Hollywood. So it did do its job, but it was a strange way to get that.
Yeah, yeah. And just to cover a little bit more of his biography and his personal life, there was obviously this event that occurred with his first wife and his kids. And after they split up, his first wife, Betty, ended up kidnapping his two children, and then he ended up in this long search with private investigators trying to find the kids and to reclaim custody, of course. All of that was immortalized in the Jeff Goldblum portrayal of Ernie Kovacs in that TV movie that was kind of hit or miss. But I mean, what was it like? What was it like for your mom in that that period of time? It must have been enormously stressful for her, as being, you know, in this relationship with Ernie, and then the ex-wife reemerges and kidnaps the kids. What was that like for her?
Well, I think she was, I mean, initially, my mom is a, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch white bread woman from, you know, Kingston, Pennsylvania, who all of a sudden is thrust into this Philadelphia show as just a gig that somebody put her up for, and finds this, you know, guy who is, you know, cigar, mustache, ethnic looking, whatever. And, you know, very quickly there's something going on, but he's married, so nothing can happen. Well, when the divorce happens, they get together, and, you know, they were in love. So in some ways it was ironic, because, you know, here she is at the best of time of her life, seeing, you know, supposedly the love of her life, and it was the love of her life, but he was going through a terrible time. But at the same time, you know, Ernie and her worked all the time. So they both had to, you know, be professional and, you know, make sure that they were where they were supposed to be at all times. And, you know, I think it was tragic, and Ernie had to be funny, you know, sometimes 3 hours a day between radio and television. But at the same time, he was trying to find his daughter. So there would be a private investigator saying, I think we found them in Alabama. And Ernie would get on a plane, you know, after one of the shows and fly down to Alabama. No, they're not here. He'd have to fly back. So he was spending a ton of money on them, too. But I think it was a case of the best of times, the worst of times, really. I think my mom, you know, she was young enough where she didn't know better and she was going to stand by her man. But at the same time, it was definitely a little out of the ordinary.
And did you know Betty and Kippy?
You know, they were probably about not 20 years older than me, but they were probably about 17 or 18 years older than me. So by the time I was in the picture, they had already sort of moved out of the house and I didn't meet them maybe 10 times in my whole life. And you probably more around the elementary school age than anything else. So not a lot of contact.
Kippy is no longer with us, right? Kippy passed away, maybe 10 years ago?
Exactly.
And you know Mia, right?
Yes, that was my half-sister, but she was my sister. I lived with her my whole life, yeah.
Wow, obviously.
Yeah, I haven't spoken to Betty in years, but, you know, Mia passed away in 1982. So there's no, I mean, she was very young when he died. She wasn't even three. So that was a bit of a tragedy, a dark cloud kind of, you know, always around that she didn't grow up without a father. You know, I think that I have some great pictures. I have some great memorabilia, but family heirlooms and things like that. He used to call her lamb chop. So I have these like, you know, little charm bracelet type things. So it's a bittersweet thing, but, you know, it was something that was always around for sure.
Wow. Wow. Have you ever been to the corner of Beverly Glen and Santa Monica Boulevard?
Oh, I went to high school not far from there. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there about 15 years ago and I had to, you know, every time I go to LA, if I have time, I try to make the pilgrimage to that intersection. Of course, that's what I'm talking about is that's where Ernie Kovacs was killed in a single car accident. He, it was late at night and the roads were wet and he was in the car that eventually became labeled as unsafe at any speed by Ralph Nader, right? It was the is a Corvair.
It was a Corvair, correct?
Yeah.
And he had come from the studio in I believe either a station wagon or the Rolls or something, a heavier car. And my mom came to this party at Billy Wilder's house for Milton Berle's adoption of his son. And they met there and it was raining and it was a January night. I think it was January 13th. And, when they left, he said, you take the heavier car. I'm going to take the Corvair. And that's what happened.
Yep.
Yeah. He got into a single car accident and that was it.
Unbelievable. You know, the first time I went there, I stood there and it was in the middle of the afternoon, broad daylight, you know, traffic, of course, on Santa Monica Boulevard. But I think as I stood there, I think passersby thought I was insane because I broke down sobbing. And that's very seldom has that ever actually happened to me where I've been out in public and it's been, I mean, I've been to battlefields, I've been to places where other people have died. But for some reason, that spot on that day just hit me over the head like a ton of bricks. And there's not a memorial. There's not a plaque there. There's not anything that says that, you know, this amazing, so influential, wonderful character in certainly 20th century American comedy is not even remembered at that spot. And I feel like, good Lord, can he ever catch a break? You know what I mean? Do you ever feel like that?
Well,
like, oh, my God, why did...
We tend to try to, you know, celebrate the births, not the deaths, but... I hear what you're saying. I mean, there's definitely moments where I feel like he doesn't get his due. But, you know, even in this world that we live in now, I mean, I bet you there's people that are 20 years old that couldn't tell you if, you know, Frank Sinatra was a jazz singer or if Elvis Presley was rock and roll. Like, they wouldn't know the difference. Yeah. So I think we're just living in a very weird environment the last, you know, reality TV 15 years where, you know, things don't, you know, connect with people like they used to. But I do feel like he got a bit of a short shift, for sure. He just, you know, I mean, the Beatles were, you know, hitting in 60, he died in 60. people's memories, you know, even then we're moving on to a totally different world, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever think about the what if, like, what if he hadn't died? And you know, because I think about the comedy that we saw in the 1970s emerging, not only with the Pythons, but also Saturday Night Live, of course. I think Ernie Kovacs would have slipped into that mentality very easily. Do you agree, or do you think he would have been disillusioned by what was going on in comedy in the 70s? I can't imagine that he would be.
Well, you know, very briefly, right before he died, excuse me, he was interviewed by the CBC, and there's an interview on one of the discs that we put out with Shout Factory on the Ernie Kovacs collection that has this. He was interviewed, and they asked him, "What's your next project?" And he said, "I'm actually writing a movie script that I'm going to direct for the character Eugene, and Alec Guinness is going to play Eugene, and I'm going to direct."
Wow.
And it was, when you think about what could have been with that scenario, it would have been fantastic, because they had made Our Man in Havana in 1959. You know, here's this, you know, Shakespearean amazing actor, and Ernie, who is sort of this crude American, but they get along like a house of fire. So, it would have been amazing. But I think Ernie would have definitely gotten into, you know, video technology, and I think that's what he would have been into. And forget about the computer, he would have been all over that.
But, oh, God, yeah.
You know, the only thing I could say is that, you know, the sort of, you know, drug culture 70s and, you know, post psychedelics. I don't know how well Ernie would have fit in there, but, you know, maybe a Nehru jacket. I don't know. That's hard to say.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, one of my weird tangential connections to the Ernie Kovacs estate is I remember talking to whoever the head of his estate was, and it was a guy who worked closely with your mom, and I forget his name, but boy, it was around 2000, and I remember talking to him about setting some of Ernie's old radio stuff to animation. It was right around the time where Flash animation was really big. It was the .com era.
Right.
And we're going to do some stuff along those lines. I can't even imagine how much fun that would have been. It kind of fell apart. Didn't really happen. But, you know, I think it would have been a great way to carry on Ernie's legacy. But it good Lord, it's so tantalizing to imagine what he could have done. And in fact, the project that I was working on with David Wally, we were really trying to interpret, like, how Ernie Kovacs would produce his own life story. That was kind of how we were trying to approach it.
Yeah. Just as an aside, the person you're thinking of, his name was Henry Bollinger.
Yeah, there you go.
My mom's
yep.
Ernie's publicist.
Thank you.
He was fantastic.
Exactly. Yep, that was him.
He just passed away about 6 months ago, but I was working with him up until the end. He was a force of nature. He was amazing.
Yeah.
But to talk about the drug culture, I don't even know why I said that, but when Saturday Night Live got their first Emmy for writing, they brought the writing staff up, and Chevy Chase took the mic and said, thank you guys very much, said whatever he said, and he said, and thank you, Ernie Kovacs.
Yeah.
So clearly, he had some impact on Saturday Night Live, for sure.
Do you think his dying early, his dying young? I mean, he was only in his early 40s at that time, right?
Yeah, correct.
Sometimes the fact that someone has died young, we kind of are able to superimpose all these amazing things onto them,
right?
That you don't normally do with someone who's living. You know what I mean?
Well, I will say this, and it may sound self-serving, but none of this would make a bit of difference if it wasn't for my mom's preservation of his shows.
Yeah.
You know, there is the fact that we have, you know, over 100 hours and plus 100 hours of audio of Ernie's stuff is purely based on the fact that my mom heard from a former technical person in one of Ernie's shows in like about 63, 64 and said, all the networks are that I'm working at NBC and they're using his tapes to make PSAs and weather reports and game shows. They didn't have any need for his masters. They were recording over them.
Mm-hmm.
So she got a lawyer and got a quit claim and bought all this Kovac stuff. So that's the only reason it survived. So we might not even be having this discussion if my mom didn't actually, you know, spend a lot of money over
Incredible.
The years, purely because she wanted to save it. I mean, when she bought this in 1964, you know, there's no home video. There's no, there's nothing. There's repeats. That's it.
Yep.
So, I kind of have to just I'm going to go with that answer.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, and then I'll let you go, Josh. And I really appreciate your time. We're running long here. Obviously, I know we only had about an hour to work with. But what are some of the events? What are some of the things going on to commemorate his 100th birthday?
Oh, you're a good man. Thank you for letting me plug some stuff.
Sure.
There is a lot of stuff on tap, 100% confirmed, not yet. But there are likely some events in Culpeper, Virginia. I will let you surmise what that means.
I know exactly where that is. I've been there many times.
Okay, good. Okay. There's also hopefully a big event with the state of New Jersey. I will leave it at that. We are talking to some museums in New York. We were talking to a fantastic institution in London where he's not very well known. So at the moment, we just finished the UCLA Film and Television Archive one, but there are probably events that are going to happen all throughout the year. And, you know, let me just say, we just signed a book deal with Fantagraphics to do a Ernie Kovacs coffee table book. And it's got some articles that you have probably never seen before, things he wrote. There was a novel that he was writing when he died called Mildred Szabo. We found the first chapter. We're going to include that. Wow. So there's some really cool, interesting stuff that we're putting together.
Well, I assure you, we could have talked for another 3-4 hours. No doubt about that.
And when we come to the Library of Congress in Culpeper, I'll have to meet you and you'll have to come out.
Sounds great. I would love to do that. I would love that very much. Thank you, Josh. Really appreciate your time.
Okay. Bye.
Mi, sol, la, re, fa, re, sol. Mi do fa re sol sol, mi sol la re fa re sol, do mi do fa re sol sol do, do mi fa si re si mi, la do la fa re sol sol, do mi do fa si re si mi.